He knew what he had to do. He twisted his body and grabbed the front of Palmieri's cassock while bringing his legs up and bracing his feet against one of the uprights of the brass balcony rail. As Palmieri turned his startled face toward him, Zev put all his strength into his legs for one convulsive backward push against the railing, pulling Palmieri with him. The vampire priest was overbalanced. Even his enormous strength could not help him once his feet came free of the floor. Zev saw his undead eyes widen with terror as his lower body slipped over the railing. As they fell free, Zev wrapped his arms around Palmieri and clutched his cold and surprisingly thin body tight against him. "What goes through this old Jew goes through you," he shouted into the vampire's ear. For an instant, he saw Joe's horrified face appear over the balcony's receding edge, heard Joe's faraway shout of "No!" mingle with Palmieri's nearer scream of the same word. Then there was a spine-cracking jar and a tearing, wrenching pain beyond all comprehension in his chest. In an eye blink, he felt the sharp spire of wood rip through him and into Palmieri. And then he felt no more. As roaring blackness closed in, he wondered if he'd done it, if this last, desperate, foolish act had succeeded. He didn't want to die without finding out. He wanted to know. But then he knew no more. Part 17. Joe shouted incoherently as he hung over the rail and watched Zev's fall, gagged as he saw the bloody point of the pew remnant burst through the back of Palmieri's cassock directly below him. He saw Palmieri squirm and flop around like a speared fish, then go limp atop Zev's already inert form. As cheers mixed with cries of horror and the sounds of renewed battle rose from the nave, Joe turned away from the balcony rail and dropped to his knees. "Zev!" he cried aloud. "Good God, Zev!" Forcing himself to his feet, he stumbled down the back stairs through the vestibule and into the nave. The vampires and the Vichy were on the run, as cowed and demoralized by their leader's death as the parishioners were buoyed by it. Slowly, steadily, they were falling before the relentless onslaught, but Joe paid them scant attention. He fought his way to where Zev lay impaled beneath Palmieri's already rotting corpse. He looked for a sign of life in his old friend's glazing eyes, a hint of a pulse in his throat under his beard. But there was nothing. "Oh, Zev, you shouldn't have. You shouldn't have." Suddenly he was surrounded by a cheering throng of St. Anthony's parishioners. "We did it, Father Joe," Carl cried, his face and hands splattered with blood. "We killed them all. We got our church back." "Thanks to this man here," Joe said, pointing to Zev. "No," someone shouted, "thanks to you." Amid the cheers, Joe shook his head and said nothing. Let them celebrate, they deserved it. They'd reclaimed a small piece of the planet as their own. A toehold and nothing more, a small victory of minimal significance in the war, but a victory nonetheless. They had their church back, at least for tonight, and they intended to keep it. Good. But there would be one change. If they wanted their Father Joe to stick around, they were going to have to agree to rename the church. St. Zev's. Joe liked the sound of that.
Is that a vampire? The Adventure of the Sussex Vampire by Arthur Conan Doyle. Doyle believed that his most important works of fiction were such historical novels and short story collections as Micah Clark, 1889, The White Company, 1892, The Exploits of Brigadier Gerard, 1896, and Sir Nigel, 1906. He He believed his most significant nonfiction work was in the spiritualism field, to which he devoted the last 20 years of his life, a considerable portion of his fortune, and prodigious energy, producing many major and not-so-major works on the subject. He was deluded, of course, as Sherlock Holmes was his supreme achievement, arguably the most famous fictional character ever created. His first appearance was in the novel A Study in Scarlet, 1887, followed by The Sign of Four, 1890, neither of which changed the course of the detective story. This occurred when the first short story, A Scandal in Bohemia, was published in the Strand magazine, July 1891, bringing the world's first private detective to a huge readership. Monthly publication of new Holmes stories became so widely anticipated that eager readers queued up at newsstands awaiting each new issue. One of the most famous Holmes axioms was that when the impossible was eliminated, whatever remained must be the truth. This theory is in great evidence in the present story. The Adventure of the Sussex Vampire was first published in the January 1924 issue of the Strand magazine. It was first collected in book form in The Casebook of Sherlock Holmes, London, John Murray, 1927.
The Adventure of the Sussex Vampire by Arthur Conan Doyle. Read by Robin Sachs. Holmes had read carefully a note which the last post had brought him. Then, with the dry chuckle which was his nearest approach to a laugh, he tossed it over to me. "For a mixture of the modern and the medieval, of the practical and of the wildly fanciful, I think this is surely the limit," said he. "What do you make of it, Watson?" I read as follows. 46 Old Jury, November 19th. Re Vampires. "Sir, our client, Mr. Robert Ferguson, of Ferguson and Muirhead, Tea Brokers of Mincing Lane, has made some inquiry from us in a communication of even date concerning vampires. As our firm specializes entirely upon the assessment of machinery, the matter hardly comes within our purview, and we have therefore recommended Mr. Ferguson to call upon you and lay the matter before you. We have not forgotten your successful action in the case of Matilda Briggs. We are, sir, faithfully yours, Morrison, Morrison and Dodd, per EJC. "Matilda Briggs was not the name of a young woman, Watson," said Holmes in a reminiscent voice. "It was a ship which is associated with the giant rat of Sumatra, a story for which the world is not yet prepared. But what do we know about vampires? Does it come within our purview, either? Anything is better than stagnation, but really we seem to have been switched on to a Grimm's fairy tale. Make a long arm, Watson, and see what V has to say." I leaned back and took down the great index volume to which he referred. Holmes balanced it on his knee, and his eyes moved slowly and lovingly over the record of old cases mixed with the accumulated information of a lifetime. "Voyage of the Gloria Scott," he read. "That was a bad business. I have some recollection that you made a record of it, Watson, though I was unable to congratulate you upon the result. Victor Lynch, the forger. Venomous lizard or gila. Remarkable case, that. Victoria, the circus bell. Vanderbilt and the Yeggman. Vipers. Vigor, the Hammersmith wonder. Hello, hello. Good old index. You can't beat it. Listen to this, Watson. Vampirism in Hungary. And again, vampires in Transylvania." He turned over the pages with eagerness, but after a short, intent perusal, he threw down the great book with a snarl of disappointment. "Rubbish, Watson, rubbish. What have we to do with walking corpses who can only be held in their grave by stakes driven through their hearts? It's pure lunacy." "But surely," said I, "the vampire was not necessarily a dead man. A living person might have the habit. I have read, for example, of the old sucking the blood of the young in order to retain their youth." "You are right, Watson. It mentions the legend in one of these references. But are we to give serious attention to such things? This agency stands flat-footed upon the ground, and there it must remain. The world is big enough for us. No ghosts need apply. I fear that we cannot take Mr. Robert Ferguson very seriously. Possibly this note may be from him, and may throw some light upon what is worrying him." He took up a second letter which had lain unnoticed upon the table while he had been absorbed with the first. This he began to read with a smile of amusement upon his face, which gradually faded away into an expression of intense interest and concentration. When he had finished, he sat for some little time, lost in thought, with the letter dangling from his fingers. Finally, with a start, he aroused himself from his reverie. "Cheeseman's, Lamberley. Where is Lamberley, Watson?" "It is in Sussex, south of Horsham." "Not very far, eh? And Cheeseman's?" "I know that country, Holmes. It is full of old houses which are named after the men who built them centuries ago. You get Audleys and Harveys and Carrotons. The folk are forgotten, but their names live in their houses."
"Precisely," said Holmes coldly. It was one of the peculiarities of his proud, self-contained nature that though he docketed any fresh information very quietly and accurately in his brain, he seldom made any acknowledgement to the giver. "I rather fancy we shall know a good deal more about Cheeseman's, Lamberley, before we are through. The letter is, as I had hoped, from Robert Ferguson. By the way, he claims acquaintance with you."
"With me?"
"You had better read it." He handed the letter across. It was headed with the address quoted. "Dear Mr. Holmes," it said, "I have been recommended to you by my lawyers, but indeed the matter is so extraordinarily delicate that it is most difficult to discuss. It concerns a friend for whom I am acting. This gentleman married some 5 years ago a Peruvian lady, the daughter of a Peruvian merchant, whom he had met in connection with the importation of nitrates. The lady was very beautiful, but the fact of her foreign birth and of her alien religion always caused a separation of interests and of feelings between husband and wife, so that after a time his love may have cooled towards her, and he may have come to regard their union as a mistake. He felt there were sides of her character which he could never explore or understand. This was the more painful as she was as loving a wife as a man could have. To all appearance, absolutely devoted. Now for the point which I will make more plain when we meet. Indeed, this note is merely to give you a general idea of the situation and to ascertain whether you would care to interest yourself in the matter. The lady began to show some curious traits, quite alien to her ordinarily sweet and gentle disposition. The gentleman had been married twice, and he had one son by the first wife. This boy was now 15, a very charming and affectionate youth, though unhappily injured through an accident in childhood. Twice the wife was caught in the act of assaulting this poor lad in the most unprovoked way. Once she struck him with a stick and left a great weal on his arm. This was a small matter, however, compared with her conduct to her own child, a dear boy just under 1 year of age. On one occasion, about a month ago, this child had been left by its nurse for a few minutes. A loud cry from the baby, as of pain, called the nurse back. As she ran into the room, she saw her employer, the lady, leaning over the baby and apparently biting his neck. There was a small wound in the neck from which a stream of blood had escaped. The nurse was so horrified that she wished to call the husband, but the lady implored her not to do so, and actually gave her £5 as a price for her silence. No explanation was ever given, and for the moment the matter was passed over. It left, however, a terrible impression upon the nurse's mind, and from that time she began to watch her mistress closely and to keep a closer guard upon the baby, whom she tenderly loved. It seemed to her that even as she watched the mother, so the mother watched her, and that every time she was compelled to leave the baby alone, the mother was waiting to get at it. Day and night the nurse covered the child, and day and night the silent, watchful mother seemed to be lying in wait as a wolf waits for a lamb.
It must read most incredible to you, and yet I beg you to take it seriously, for a child's life and a man's sanity may depend upon it. At last, there came one dreadful day when the facts could no longer be concealed from the husband. The nurse's nerve had given way. She could stand the strain no longer, and she made a clean breast of it all to the man. To him it seemed as wild a tale as it may now seem to you. He knew his wife to be a loving wife, and save for the assaults upon her stepson, a loving mother. Why, then, should she wound her own dear little baby? He told the nurse that she was dreaming, that her suspicions were those of a lunatic, and that such libels upon her mistress were not to be tolerated. While they were talking, a sudden cry of pain was heard. Nurse and master rushed together to the nursery. Imagine his feelings, Mr. Holmes, as he saw his wife rise from a kneeling position beside the cot and saw blood upon the child's exposed neck and upon the sheet. With a cry of horror, he turned his wife's face to the light and saw blood all round her lips. It was she, beyond all question, who had drunk the poor baby's blood. So the matter stands. She is now confined to her room. There has been no explanation. The husband is half demented. He knows, and I know, little of vampirism beyond the name. We had thought it was some wild tale of foreign parts, and yet here in the very heart of the English Sussex, well, all this can be discussed with you in the morning. Will you see me? Will you use your great powers in aiding a distracted man? If so, kindly wire to Ferguson Cheeseman's Lamberley, and I will be at your rooms by 10 o'clock. Yours faithfully, Robert Ferguson. P.S. I believe your friend Watson played rugby for Blackheath when I was 3/4 for Richmond. It is the only personal introduction which I can give. Of course I remembered him, said I as I laid down the letter. Big Bob Ferguson, the finest 3/4 Richmond ever had. He was always a good-natured chap. It's like him to be so concerned over a friend's case. Holmes looked at me thoughtfully and shook his head. I never get your limits, Watson, he said. There are unexplored possibilities about you. Take a wire down, like a good fellow. We'll examine your case with pleasure. Your case? We must not let him think that this agency is weak-minded. Of course it is his case. Send him that wire and let the matter rest till morning. Promptly at 10 o'clock next morning, Ferguson strode into our room. I had remembered him as a long, slab-sided man with loose limbs and a fine turn of speed, which had carried him round many an opposing back. There is surely nothing in life more painful than to meet the wreck of a fine athlete whom one has known in his prime. His great frame had fallen in, his flaxen hair was scanty, and his shoulders were bowed. I fear that I roused corresponding emotions in him. "Hello, Watson," said he, and his voice was still deep and hearty. "You don't look quite the man you did when I threw you over the ropes into the crowd at the old deer park. I expect I have changed a bit also. But it's this last day or two that has aged me. I see by your telegram, Mr. Holmes, that it is no use my pretending to be anyone's deputy."
"It is simpler to deal direct," said Holmes.
"Of course it is. But you can imagine how difficult it is when you are speaking of the one woman whom you are bound to protect and help. What can I do? How am I to go to the police with such a story? And yet the kiddies have got to be protected. Is it madness, Mr. Holmes? Is it something in the blood? Have you any similar case in your experience? For God's sake, give me some advice, for I am at my wit's end."
"Very naturally, Mr. Ferguson. Now sit here and pull yourself together and give me a few clear answers. I can assure you that I am very far from being at my wit's end, and that I am confident we shall find some solution. First of all, tell me what steps you have taken. Is your wife still near the children?"
"We had a dreadful scene. She is a most loving woman, Mr. Holmes. If ever a woman loved a man with all her heart and soul, she loves me. She was cut to the heart that I should have discovered this horrible, this incredible secret. She would not even speak. She gave no answer to my reproaches, save to gaze at me with a sort of wild, despairing look in her eyes. Then she rushed to her room and locked herself in. Since then, she has refused to see me. She has a maid who was with her before her marriage, Dolores by name, a friend rather than a servant. She takes her food to her. Then the child is in no immediate danger. Mrs. Mason, the nurse, has sworn that she will not leave it night or day. I can absolutely trust her. I am more uneasy about poor little Jack, for, as I told you in my note, he has twice been assaulted by her. But never wounded? No, she struck him savagely. It is the more terrible as he is a poor little inoffensive cripple. Ferguson's gaunt features softened as he spoke of his boy. You would think that the dear lad's condition would soften anyone's heart. A fallen childhood and a twisted spine, Mr. Holmes, but the dearest, most loving heart within. Holmes had picked up the letter of yesterday and was reading it over. What other inmates are there in your house, Mr. Ferguson? Two servants, who have not been long with us. One stable hand, Michael, who sleeps in the house. My wife, myself, my boy Jack, baby, Dolores, and Mrs. Mason. That is all. I gather that you did not know your wife well at the time of your marriage. I had only known her a few weeks. How long had this maid Dolores been with her? Some years. Then your wife's character would really be better known by Dolores than by you. Yes, you may say so. Holmes made a note. I fancy, said he, that I may be of more use at Lamberley than here. It is eminently a case for personal investigation. If the lady remains in her room, our presence could not annoy or inconvenience her. Of course, we would stay at the inn. Ferguson gave a gesture of relief. It is what I hoped, Mr. Holmes. There is an excellent train at 2 from Victoria, if you could come. Of course we could come. There is a lull at present. I can give you my undivided energies. Watson, of course, comes with us. But there are one or two points upon which I wish to be very sure before I start. This unhappy lady, as I understand it, has appeared to assault both the children, her own baby and your little son. That is so. But the assaults take different forms, do they not? She has beaten your son. Once with a stick, and once very savagely with her hands. Did she give no explanation why she struck him? None, save that she hated him. Again and again she said so. Well, that is not unknown among stepmothers. A posthumous jealousy, we will say. Is the lady jealous by nature? Yes, she is very jealous, jealous with all the strength of her fiery tropical love. But the boy, he is 15, I understand, and probably very developed in mind, since his body has been circumscribed in action. Did he give you no explanation of these assaults? No, he declared there was no reason. Were they good friends at other times? No, there was never any love between them. Yet you say he is affectionate? Never in the world could there be so devoted a son. My life is his life. He is absorbed in what I say or do. Once again, Holmes made a note. For some time, he sat lost in thought. No doubt you and the boy were great comrades before this second marriage. You were thrown very close together, were you not? Very much so. And the boy, having so affectionate a nature, was devoted, no doubt, to the memory of his mother. Most devoted. He would certainly seem to be a most interesting lad. There is one other point about these assaults. Were the strange attacks upon the baby and the assaults upon your son at the same period?
In the first case, it was so. It was as if some frenzy had seized her, and she had vented her rage upon both. In the second case, it was only Jack who suffered. Mrs. Mason had no complaint to make about the baby.
That certainly complicates matters.
I don't quite follow you, Mr. Holmes.
Possibly not. One forms provisional theories and waits for time or fuller knowledge to explode them. A bad habit, Mr. Ferguson, but human nature is weak. I fear that your old friend here has given an exaggerated view of my scientific methods. However, I will only say at the present stage that your problem does not appear to me to be insoluble, and that you may expect to find us at Victoria at 2 o'clock. It was evening of a dull, foggy November day when, having left our bags at the Chequers, Lamberley, we drove through the Sussex clay of a long, winding lane, and finally reached the isolated and ancient farmhouse in which Ferguson dwelt. It was a large, straggling building, very old in the centre, very new at the wings, with towering Tudor chimneys and a lichen-spotted, high-pitched roof of Horsham slabs. The doorsteps were worn into curves, and the ancient tiles which lined the porch were marked with the rebus of a cheese and a man after the original builder. Within, the ceilings were corrugated with heavy oaken beams, and the uneven floors sagged into sharp curves. An odour of age and decay pervaded the whole crumbling building. There was one very large central room into which Ferguson led us. Here, in a huge old-fashioned fireplace with an iron screen behind it, dated 1670, there blazed and spluttered a splendid log fire. The room, as I gazed round, was a most singular mixture of dates and of places. The half-panelled walls may well have belonged to the original yeoman farmer of the 17th century. They were ornamented, however, on the lower part, by a line of well-chosen modern watercolours, while above, where yellow plaster took the place of oak, there was hung a fine collection of South American utensils and weapons, which had been brought, no doubt, by the Peruvian lady upstairs. Holmes rose with that quick curiosity which sprang from his eager mind, and examined them with some care. He returned with his eyes full of thought. "Hallo!" he cried. "Hallo!" A spaniel had lain in a basket in the corner. It came slowly forward towards its master, walking with difficulty. Its hind legs moved irregularly, and its tail was on the ground. It licked Ferguson's hand.
"What is it, Mr. Holmes?"
"The dog. What's the matter with it?"
"That's what puzzled the vet. A sort of paralysis. Spinal meningitis, he thought. But it is passing. He'll be all right soon, won't you, Carlo?"
A shiver of assent passed through the drooping tail. The dog's mournful eyes passed from one of us to the other. He knew that we were discussing his case.
"Did it come on suddenly?"
"In a single night."
"How long ago?"
"It may have been 4 months ago."
"Very remarkable. Very suggestive."
"What do you see in it, Mr. Holmes?"
"A confirmation of what I had already thought."
"For God's sake, what do you think, Mr. Holmes? It may be a mere intellectual puzzle to you, but it is life and death to me. My wife, a would-be murderer. My child in constant danger. Don't play with me, Mr. Holmes. It is too terribly serious."
The big rugby three-quarter was trembling all over. Holmes put his hand soothingly upon his arm. "I fear that there is pain for you, Mr. Ferguson, whatever the solution may be," said he. "I would spare you all I can. I cannot say more for the instant, but before I leave this house, I hope I may have something definite."
"Please God, you may. If you will excuse me, gentlemen, I will go up to my wife's room and see if there has been any change."
He was away some minutes, during which Holmes resumed his examination of the curiosities upon the wall. When our host returned, it was clear from his downcast face that he had made no progress. He brought with him a tall, slim, brown-faced girl.
"The tea is ready, Dolores," said Ferguson. "See that your mistress has everything she can wish."
"She very ill," cried the girl, looking with indignant eyes at her master. "She no ask for food. She very ill. She need doctor. I frightened to stay alone with her without doctor."
Ferguson looked at me with a question in his eyes.
I should be so glad if I could be of use.
Would your mistress see Dr. Watson?
I take him. I no ask leave. She needs doctor. Then I'll come with you at once.
I followed the girl, who was quivering with strong emotion, up the staircase and down an ancient corridor. At the end was an iron-clamped and massive door. It struck me as I looked at it that if Ferguson tried to force his way to his wife, he would find it no easy matter. The girl drew a key from her pocket, and the heavy oaken planks creaked upon their old hinges. I passed in, and she swiftly followed, fastening the door behind her. On the bed, a woman was lying who was clearly in a high fever. She was only half conscious, but as I entered, she raised a pair of frightened but beautiful eyes and glared at me in apprehension. Seeing a stranger, she appeared to be relieved and sank back with a sigh upon the pillow. I stepped up to her with a few reassuring words, and she lay still while I took her pulse and temperature. Both were high, and yet my impression was that the condition was rather that of mental and nervous excitement than of any actual seizure.
"She lied like that one day, 2 days. I afraid she die," said the girl.
The woman turned her flushed and handsome face towards me.
"Where is my husband?"
"He is below and would wish to see you."
"I will not see him. I will not see him."
Then she seemed to wander off into delirium.
"A fiend! A fiend! Oh, what shall I do with this devil?"
"Can I help you in any way?"
"No. No one can help. It is finished. All is destroyed. Do what I will. All is destroyed."
The woman must have some strange delusion. I could not see honest Bob Ferguson in the character of fiend or devil.
"Madam," I said, "your husband loves you dearly. He is deeply grieved at this happening."
Again she turned on me those glorious eyes.
"He loves me,
yes.
But do I not love him? Do I not love him even to sacrifice myself rather than break his dear heart? That is how I love him. And yet he could think of me. He could speak to me so.
He is full of grief, but he cannot understand."
"No, he cannot understand. But he should trust."
"Will you not see him?" I suggested.
"No, no, I cannot forget those terrible words, nor the look upon his face. I will not see him. Go now. You can do nothing for me. Tell him only one thing. I want my child. I have a right to my child. That is the only message I can send him."
She turned her face to the wall and would say no more. I returned to the room downstairs, where Ferguson and Holmes still sat by the fire. Ferguson listened moodily to my account of the interview.
"How can I send her the child?" he said. "How do I know what strange impulse might come upon her? How can I ever forget how she rose from beside it with its blood upon her lips?"
He shuddered at the recollection.
"The child is safe with Mrs. Mason, and there he must remain."
A smart maid, the only modern thing which we had seen in the house, had brought in some tea. As she was serving it, the door opened and a youth entered the room. He was a remarkable lad, pale-faced and fair-haired, with excitable light blue eyes which blazed into a sudden flame of emotion and joy as they rested upon his father. He rushed forward and threw his arms round his neck with the abandon of a loving girl.
"Oh, Daddy," he cried, "I did not know that you were due yet. I should have been here to meet you. Oh, I am so glad to see you."
Ferguson gently disengaged himself from the embrace with some little show of embarrassment.
"Dear old chap," said he,
patting the flaxen head with a very tender hand.
"I came early because my friends, Mr. Holmes and Dr. Watson, have been persuaded to come down and spend an evening with us."
"Is that Mr. Holmes, the detective?"
"Yes."
The youth looked at us with a very penetrating and, as it seemed to me, unfriendly gaze. "What about your other child, Mr. Ferguson?" asked Holmes. "Might we make the acquaintance of the baby?"
"Ask Mrs. Mason to bring baby down," said Ferguson.
The boy went off with a curious, shambling gait, which told my surgical eyes that he was suffering from a weak spine. Presently he returned, and behind him came a tall, gaunt woman, bearing in her arms a very beautiful child, dark-eyed, golden-haired, a wonderful mixture of the Saxon and the Latin. Ferguson was evidently devoted to it, for he took it into his arms and fondled it most tenderly.
"Fancy anyone having the heart to hurt him," he muttered, as he glanced down at the small, angry red pucker upon the cherub throat.
It was at this moment that I chanced to glance at Holmes and saw a most singular intentness in his expression. His face was as set as if it had been carved out of old ivory, and his eyes, which had glanced for a moment at father and child, were now fixed with eager curiosity upon something at the other side of the room. Following his gaze, I could only guess that he was looking out through the window at the melancholy, dripping garden. It is true that a shutter had half closed outside and obstructed the view, but nonetheless it was certainly at the window that Holmes was fixing his concentrated attention. Then he smiled, and his eyes came back to the baby. On its chubby neck there was this small, puckered mark. Without speaking, Holmes examined it with care. Finally, he shook one of the dimpled fists which waved in front of him. "Goodbye, little man. You have made a strange start in life. Nurse, I should wish to have a word with you in private." He took her aside and spoke earnestly for a few minutes. I only heard the last words, which were, "Your anxiety will soon, I hope, be set at rest." The woman, who seemed to be a sour, silent kind of creature, withdrew with the child. "What is Mrs. Mason like?" asked Holmes.
"Not very prepossessing externally, as you can see, but a heart of gold, and devoted to the child."
"Do you like her, Jack?" Holmes turned suddenly upon the boy, his expressive, mobile face shadowed over, and he shook his head.
"Jackie has very strong likes and dislikes," said Ferguson, putting his arm round the boy. "Luckily, I am one of his likes."
The boy cooed and nestled his head upon his father's breast. Ferguson gently disengaged him.
"Run away, little Jackie," said he,
and he watched his son with loving eyes until he disappeared.
"Now, Mr. Holmes," he continued when the boy was gone, "I really feel that I have brought you on a fool's errand, for what can you possibly do save give me your sympathy? It must be an exceedingly delicate and complex affair from your point of view."
"It certainly is delicate," said my friend with an amused smile, "but I have not been struck up to now with its complexity. It has been a case for intellectual deduction, but when this original intellectual deduction is confirmed point by point by quite a number of independent incidents, then the subjective becomes objective, and we can say confidently that we have reached our goal. I had, in fact, reached it before we left Baker Street, and the rest has merely been observation and confirmation." Ferguson put his big hand to his furrowed forehead.
"For heaven's sake, Holmes," he said hoarsely, "if you can see the truth in this matter, do not keep me in suspense. How do I stand? What shall I do? I care nothing as to how you have found your facts, so long as you have really got them."
Certainly, I owe you an explanation, and you shall have it. But you will permit me to handle the matter in my own way. Is the lady capable of seeing us, Watson?
She is ill, but she is quite rational.
Very good. It is only in her presence that we can clear the matter up. Let us go up to her.
She will not see me, cried Ferguson.
Oh, yes, she will, said Holmes. He scribbled a few lines upon a sheet of paper. You at least have the entree, Watson. Will you have the goodness to give the lady this note? I ascended again and handed the note to Dolores, who cautiously opened the door. A minute later, I heard a cry from within, a cry in which joy and surprise seemed to be blended. Dolores looked out.
She will see them. She will listen, said she.
At my summons, Ferguson and Holmes came up. As we entered the room, Ferguson took a step or two towards his wife, who had raised herself in the bed, but she held out her hand to repulse him. He sank into an armchair while Holmes seated himself beside him, after bowing to the lady, who looked at him with wide-eyed amazement. "I think we can dispense with Dolores," said Holmes. "Oh, very well, madame, if you would rather she stayed, I can see no objection. Now, Mr. Ferguson, I am a busy man with many calls, and my methods have to be short and direct. The swiftest surgery is the least painful. Let me first say what will ease your mind. Your wife is a very good, a very loving, and a very ill-used woman." Ferguson sat up with a cry of joy.
"Prove that, Mr. Holmes, and I am your debtor forever."
"I will do so, but in doing so I must wound you deeply in another direction."
"I care nothing so long as you clear my wife. Everything on earth is insignificant compared to that."
"Let me tell you, then, the train of reasoning which passed through my mind in Baker Street. The idea of a vampire was to me absurd. Such things do not happen in criminal practice in England, and yet your observation was precise. You had seen the lady rise from beside the child's cot with the blood upon her lips."
"I did."
"Did it not occur to you that a bleeding wound may be sucked for some other purpose than to draw the blood from it? Was there not a queen in English history who sucked such a wound to draw poison from it?"
"Poison?"
"A South American household. My instinct felt the presence of those weapons upon the wall before my eyes ever saw them. It might have been other poison, but that was what occurred to me. When I saw that little empty quiver beside the small bird bow, it was just what I expected to see. If the child were pricked with one of those arrows dipped in curare or some other devilish drug, it would mean death if the venom were not sucked out. And the dog, if one were to use such a poison, would one not try it first in order to see that it had not lost its power? I did not foresee the dog, but at least I understand him, and he fitted into my reconstruction. Now do you understand? Your wife feared such an attack. She saw it made and saved the child's life, and yet she shrank from telling you all the truth, for she knew how you loved the boy, and feared lest it break your heart.
Jackie!
I watched him as you fondled the child just now. His face was clearly reflected in the glass of the window, where the shutter formed a background. I saw such jealousy, such cruel hatred, as I have seldom seen in a human face.
My Jackie!
You have to face it, Mr. Ferguson. It is the more painful because it is a distorted love, a maniacal, exaggerated love for you, and possibly for his dead mother, which has prompted his action. His very soul is consumed with hatred for this splendid child, whose health and beauty are a contrast to his own weakness.
Good God! It is incredible!
Have I spoken the truth, madam? The lady was sobbing, with her face buried in the pillows. Now she turned to her husband.
How could I tell you, Bob? I felt the blow it would be to you. It was better that I should wait, and that it should come from some other lips than mine. When this gentleman, who seems to have powers of magic, wrote that he knew all, I was glad. I think a year at sea would be my prescription for Master Jackie, said Holmes, rising from his chair. Only one thing is still clouded, madam. We can quite understand your attacks upon Master Jackie. There is a limit to a mother's patience. But how did you dare to leave the child these last 2 days?
I had told Mrs. Mason. She knew.
Exactly. So I imagined. Ferguson was standing by the bed, choking, his hands outstretched and quivering.
This, I fancy, is the time for our exit, Watson, said Holmes in a whisper. If you will take one elbow of the too faithful Dolores, I will take the other.
There now, he added, as he closed the door behind him, I think we may leave them to settle the rest among themselves. I have only one further note of this case. It is the letter which Holmes wrote in final answer to that with which the narrative begins. It ran thus. Baker Street, November 21st. Re-Vampires. Sir, referring to your letter of the 19th, I beg to state that I have looked into the inquiry of your client, Mr. Robert Ferguson, of Ferguson and Muirhead, tea brokers of Mincing Lane, and that the matter has been brought to a satisfactory conclusion. With thanks for your recommendation, I am, sir, faithfully yours, Sherlock Holmes.
A Dead Finger by Sabine Baring Gould. Sabine Baring Gould, 1834 to 1924, was the son of a squire and the grandson of an admiral in North Devon, inheriting an estate of 3,000 acres. After graduating with a B.A. and an M.A. from Clark College, Cambridge University, he became curate in his mill town and fell in love with a beautiful 16-year-old mill hand. He paid for her education and married her in 1868. They had 15 children. This transformation of the uneducated young girl served as the inspiration for George Bernard Shaw's play Pygmalion and the subsequent musical based on it, My Fair Lady. While his somewhat stodgy and pious novels are no longer read today, his reputation could comfortably stand the test of time because of his contribution to collecting and preserving English folk songs, and as the writer of such hymns as the justly famous Onward Christian Soldiers, And Now the Day is Done. Perhaps strangely for a man of the cloth and author of religious works, he also produced scholarly works about fantastical medieval myths and lore, such as The Book of Werewolves and Curious Myths of the Middle Ages, leading to the authoring of several enduring works of horror and supernatural fiction. A Dead Finger was first published in book form in A Book of Ghosts, London, Methuen, 1904.
A Dead Finger by Sabine Baring Gould. Read by Jonathan Cowley. Part 1. Why the National Gallery should not attract so many visitors as, say, the British Museum, I cannot explain. The latter does not contain much that, one would suppose, appeals to the interest of the ordinary sightseer. What knows such of prehistoric flints and scratched bones, of Assyrian sculpture, of Egyptian hieroglyphics? The Greek and Roman statuary is cold and dead. The paintings in the National Gallery glow with colour and are instinct with life. Yet somehow, a few listless wanderers saunter yawning through the National Gallery, whereas swarms pour through the halls of the British Museum and talk and pass remarks about the objects there exposed, of the date and meaning of which they have not the faintest conception. I was thinking of this problem and endeavouring to unravel it one morning while sitting in the room for English masters at the great collection in Trafalgar Square. At the same time, another thought forced itself upon me. I had been through the rooms devoted to foreign schools, and had then come into that given over to Reynolds, Morland, Gainsborough, Constable, and Hogarth. The morning had been for a while propitious, but towards noon a dense umber-tinted fog had come on, making it all but impossible to see the pictures, and quite impossible to do them justice. I was tired, and so seated myself on one of the chairs, and fell into the consideration first of all of why the National Gallery is not as popular as it should be, and secondly, how it was that the British school had no beginnings, like those of Italy and the Netherlands. We can see the art of the painter from its first initiation in the Italian peninsula, and among the Flemings. It starts on its progress like a child, and we can trace every stage of its growth. Not so with English art. It springs to life in full and splendid maturity. Who were there before Reynolds and Gainsborough and Hogarth? The great names of those portrait and subject painters who have left their canvases upon the walls of our country houses were those of foreigners. Holbein, Kneller, Van Dyck, and Lely for portraits, and Menuhier for flower and fruit pieces. Landscapes, figure subjects were all importations, none homegrown. How came that about? Was there no Limner that was native? Was it that fashion trampled on homegrown pictorial beginnings as it flouted and spurned native music? Here was food for contemplation. Dreaming in the brown fog, looking through it without seeing its beauties, at Hogarth's painting of Lavinia Fenton as Polly Peachum, without wondering how so indifferent a beauty could have captivated the Duke of Bolton and held him for 30 years, I was recalled to myself and my surroundings by the strange conduct of a lady who had seated herself on a chair near me, also discouraged by the fog and awaiting its dispersion. I had noticed her particularly. At the present moment, I do not remember particularly what she was like. So far as I can recollect, she was middle-aged, and was quietly yet well-dressed. It was not her face nor her dress that attracted my attention and disturbed the current of my thoughts. The effect I speak of was produced by her strange movements and behaviour. She had been sitting listless, probably thinking of nothing at all, or nothing in particular, when, in turning her eyes round, and finding that she could see nothing of the paintings, she began to study me. This did not concern me greatly. A cat may look at the king, but to be contemplated by a lady is a compliment sufficient to please any gentleman. It was not gratified vanity that troubled my thoughts, but the consciousness that my appearance produced, first of all, a startled surprise, then undisguised alarm, and finally, indescribable horror. Now a man can sit quietly leaning on the head of his umbrella, and glow internally, warmed and illumined by the consciousness that he is being surveyed with admiration by a lovely woman, even when he is middle-aged and not fashionably dressed. But no man can maintain his composure when he discovers himself to be an object of aversion and terror. What was it? I passed my hand over my chin and upper lip, thinking it not possible that I might have forgotten to shave that morning, and in my confusion, not considering that the fog would prevent the lady from discovering neglect in this particular, had it occurred, which it had not. I am a little careless, perhaps, about shaving when in the country, but when in town, never. The next idea that occurred to me was a smut. Had a London black curdled in that dense pea-soup atmosphere descended on my nose and blackened it? I hastily drew my silk handkerchief from my pocket, moistened it, and passed to my nose, and then each cheek. I then turned my eyes into the corners and looked at the lady, to see whether by this means I had got rid of what was objectionable in my personal appearance. Then I saw that her eyes, dilated with horror, were riveted, not on my face, but on my leg. My leg! What on earth could that harmless member have in it, so terrifying? The morning had been dull. There had been rain in the night, and I admit that on leaving my hotel I had turned up the bottoms of my trousers. That is a proceeding not so uncommon, not so outrageous as to account for the stony stare of this woman's eyes. If that were all, I would turn my trousers down. Then I saw her shrink from the chair on which she sat to one further removed from me, but still with her eyes fixed on my leg, about the level of my knee. She had let fall her umbrella and was grasping the seat of her chair with both hands as she backed from me. I need hardly say that I was greatly disturbed in mind and feelings, and forgot all about the origin of the English schools of painters, and the question why the British Museum is more popular than the National Gallery. Thinking that I might have been spattered by a hansom whilst crossing Oxford Street, I passed my hand down my side hastily, with a sense of annoyance, and all at once touched something cold, clammy, that sent a thrill to my heart and made me start and take a step forward. At the same moment, the lady, with a cry of horror, sprang to her feet and with raised hands fled from the room, leaving her umbrella where it had fallen. There were other visitors to the picture gallery besides ourselves, who had been passing through the saloon, and they turned at her cry and looked in surprise after her. The policeman stationed in the room came to me and asked what had happened. I was in such agitation that I hardly knew what to answer. I told him that I could explain what had occurred little better than himself. I had noticed that the lady had worn an odd expression and had behaved in the most extraordinary fashion, and that he had best take charge of her umbrella and wait for her return to claim it. This questioning by the official was vexing, as it prevented me from at once and on the spot investigating the cause of her alarm and mine, hers at something she must have seen on my leg, and mine at something I had distinctly felt creeping up my leg. The numbing and sickening effect on me of the touch of the object I had not seen was not to be shaken off at once. Indeed, I felt as though my hand were contaminated, and that I could have no rest till I had thoroughly washed the hand, and, if possible, washed away the feeling that had been produced. I looked on the floor. I examined my leg, but saw nothing. As I wore my overcoat, it was probably that in rising from my seat the skirt had fallen over my trousers and hidden the thing, whatever it was. I therefore hastily removed my overcoat and shook it. Then I looked at my trousers. There was nothing whatever on my leg, and nothing fell from my overcoat when shaken. Accordingly, I reinvested myself and hastily left the gallery, then took my way as speedily as I could, without actually running, to Charing Cross Station and down the narrow way leading to the Metropolitan, where I went into Faulkner's bath and hairdressing establishment and asked for hot water to thoroughly wash my hand and well soap it. I bathed my hand in water as hot as I could endure it, employed carbolic soap, and then, after having a good brush down, especially on my left side where my hand had encountered the object that had so affected me, I left. I had entertained the intention of going to the Princess's Theatre that evening and of securing a ticket in the morning, but all thought of theatre-going was gone from me. I could not free my heart from the sense of nausea and cold that had been produced by the touch. I went into Gatti's to have lunch and ordered something, I forget what, but when served, I found that my appetite was gone. I could eat nothing. The food inspired me with disgust. I thrust it from me untasted, and, after drinking a couple of glasses of claret, left the restaurant and returned to my hotel. Feeling sick and faint, I threw my overcoat over the sofa back and cast myself on my bed. I do not know that there was any particular reason for my doing so, but as I lay, my eyes were on my great coat. The density of the fog had passed away, and there was light again. Not of first quality, but sufficient for a Londoner to swear by, so that I could see everything in my room, though through a veil, darkly. I do not think my mind was occupied in any way. About the only occasions on which, to my knowledge, my mind is actually passive or inert is when crossing the Channel in the Foam from Dover to Calais, when I am always, in every weather, abjectly seasick and thoughtless. But as I now lay on my bed, uncomfortable, squeamish, without knowing why, I was in the same inactive mental condition, but not for long. I saw something that startled me. First, it appeared to me as if the lappet on my overcoat pocket were in movement, being raised. I did not pay much attention to this, as I supposed that the garment was sliding down onto the seat of the sofa from the back, and that this displacement of gravity caused the movement I observed. But this I soon saw was not the case. That which moved the lappet was something in the pocket that was struggling to get out. I could see now that it was working its way up the inside, and that when it reached the opening it lost balance and fell down again. I could make this out by the projections and indentations in the cloth. These moved as the creature, or whatever it was, worked its way up the lining. A mouse, I said, and forgot my seediness. I was interested. The little rascal! However did he contrive to seat himself in my pocket? And I have worn that overcoat all the morning! But no, it was not a mouse. I saw something white poke its way out from under the lappet, and in another moment an object was revealed that, though revealed, I could not understand, nor could I distinguish what it was. Now roused by curiosity, I raised myself on my elbow. In doing this, I made some noise. The bed creaked. Instantly, the something dropped on the floor, lay outstretched for a moment to recover itself, and then began, with the motions of a maggot, to run along the floor. There is a caterpillar called the measurer, because when it advances, it draws its tail up to where its head is, and then throws forward its full length, and again draws up its extremity, forming at each time a loop, and with each step measuring its total length. The object I now saw on the floor was advancing precisely like the measuring caterpillar. It had the colour of a cheese maggot, and in length was about 3.5 inches. It was not, however, like a caterpillar, which is flexible throughout its entire length, but this was, as it seemed to me, jointed in two places, one joint being more conspicuous than the other. For some moments I was so completely paralysed by astonishment that I remained motionless, looking at the thing as it crawled along the carpet, a dull green carpet with darker green, almost black flowers in it. It had, as it seemed to me, a glossy head, distinctly marked, but as the light was not brilliant, I could not make out very clearly, and moreover, the rapid movements prevented close scrutiny. Presently, with a shock still more startling than that produced by its apparition at the opening of the pocket of my great coat, I became convinced that what I saw was a finger, a human forefinger, and that the glossy head was no other than the nail. The finger did not seem to have been amputated. There was no sign of blood or laceration where the knuckle should be, but the extremity of the finger, or root rather, faded away to indistinctness, and I was unable to make out the root of the finger. I could see no hand, no body behind the finger, nothing whatever except a finger that had little token of warm life in it, no coloration as though blood circulated in it, and this finger was in active motion creeping along the carpet towards a wardrobe that stood against the wall by the fireplace. I sprang off the bed and pursued it. Evidently, the finger was alarmed, for it redoubled its pace, reached the wardrobe and went under it. By the time I had arrived at the article of furniture, it had disappeared. I lit a Vesta match and held it beneath the wardrobe, that was raised above the carpet by about 2 inches on turned feet, but I could see nothing more of the finger. I got my umbrella and thrust it beneath, and raked forwards and backwards, right and left, and raked out flue, and nothing more solid. Part 2. I packed my portmanteau next day and returned to my home in the country. All desire for amusement in town was gone, and the faculty to transact business had departed as well. A languor and qualms had come over me, and my head was in a maze. I was unable to fix my thoughts on anything. At times I was disposed to believe that my wits were deserting me, at others that I was on the verge of a severe illness. Anyhow, whether likely to go off my head or not, or take to my bed, home was the only place for me, and home would I sped accordingly. On reaching my country habitation, my servant, as usual, took my portmanteau to my bedroom, unstrapped it, but did not unpack it. I object to his throwing out the contents of my Gladstone bag, not that there is anything in it he may not see, but that he puts my things where I cannot find them again. My clothes, he is welcome to place them where he likes and where they belong, and this latter he knows better than I do, but then I carry about with me other things than a dress suit, and changes of linen and flannel. There are letters, papers, books, and the proper destinations of these are known only to myself. A servant has a singular and evil knack of putting away literary matter and odd volumes in such places that it takes the owner half a day to find them again. Although I was uncomfortable, and my head in a whirl, I opened up and unpacked my own portmanteau. As I was thus engaged, I saw something curled up in my collar box, the lid of which had got broken in by a boot heel impinging on it. I had pulled off the damaged cover to see if my collars had been spoiled, when something curled up inside suddenly rose on end and leapt, just like a cheese jumper, out of the box, over the edge of the Gladstone bag and scurried away across the floor in a manner already familiar to me. I could not doubt for a moment what it was. Here was the finger again. It had come with me from London to the country. Whither it went in its run over the floor, I do not know. I was too bewildered to observe. Somewhat later, towards evening, I seated myself in my easy chair, took up a book, and tried to read. I was tired with the journey, with the knocking about in town, and the discomfort and alarm produced by the apparition of the finger. I felt worn out. I was unable to give my attention to what I read, and before I was aware, was asleep. Roused for an instant by the fall of the book from my hands, I speedily relapsed into unconsciousness. I am not sure that a doze in an armchair ever does good. It usually leaves me in a semi-stupid condition and with a headache. 5 minutes in a horizontal position on my bed is worth 30 in a chair. That is my experience. In sleeping in a sedentary position, the head is a difficulty. It drops forward or lolls on one side or the other, and has to be brought back into a position in which the line to the centre of gravity runs through the trunk. Otherwise, the head carries the body over in a sort of general capsize out of the chair onto the floor. I slept, on the occasion of which I am speaking, pretty healthily because deadly weary. But I was brought to waking, not by my head falling over the arm of the chair, and my trunk tumbling after it, but by a feeling of cold extending from my throat to my heart. When I awoke, I was in a diagonal position, with my right ear resting on my right shoulder, and exposing the left side of my throat, and it was here, where the jugular vein throbs, that I felt the greatest intensity of cold. At once I shrugged my left shoulder, rubbing my neck with the collar of my coat in so doing. Immediately something fell off upon the floor, and I again saw the finger. My disgust, horror, were intensified when I perceived that it was dragging something after it, which might have been an old stocking, and which I took at first glance for something of the sort. The evening sun shone in through my window in a brilliant golden ray that lighted the object as it scrambled along. With this illumination, I was able to distinguish what the object was. It is not easy to describe it, but I will make the attempt. The finger I saw was solid and material. What it drew after it was neither, or was in a nebulous, protoplasmic condition. The finger was attached to a hand that was curdling into matter and in process of acquiring solidity. Attached to the hand was an arm in a very flimsy condition, and this arm belonged to a human body in a still more vaporous, immaterial condition. This was being dragged along the floor by the finger, just as a silkworm might pull after it the tangle of its web. I could see legs and arms and head and coat-tail tumbling about and interlacing and disentangling again in a promiscuous manner. There were no bone, no muscle, no substance in the figure. The members were attached to the trunk, which was spineless, but they had evidently no functions, and were wholly dependent on the finger which pulled them along in a jumble of parts as it advanced. In such confusion did the whole vaporous matter seem that I think, I cannot say for certain it was so, but the impression left on my mind was that one of the eyeballs was looking out at a nostril, and the tongue lolling out of one of the ears. It was, however, only for a moment that I saw this germ body. I cannot call by another name that which had not more substance than smoke. I saw it only so long as it was being dragged athwart the ray of sunlight. The moment it was pulled jerkily out of the beam into the shadow beyond, I could see nothing of it, only the crawling finger. I had not sufficient moral energy or physical force in me to rise, pursue, and stamp on the finger and grind it with my heel into the floor. Both seemed drained out of me. What became of the finger, whither it went, how it managed to secrete itself, I do not know. I had lost the power to inquire. I sat in my chair, chilled, staring before me into space. "Please, sir," a voice said, "there's Mr. Square below, electrical engineer." "Eh?" I looked dreamily round. My valet was at the door. "Please, sir, the gentleman would be glad to be allowed to go over the house and see that all the electrical apparatus is in order." "Oh, indeed. Yes, show him up." Part 3. I had recently placed the lighting of my house in the hands of an electrical engineer, a very intelligent man, Mr. Square, for whom I had contracted a sincere friendship. He had built a shed with a dynamo out of sight, and had entrusted the laying of the wires to subordinates, as he had been busy with other orders and could not personally watch every detail. But he was not the man to let anything pass unobserved, and he knew that electricity was not a force to be played with. Bad or careless workmen will often insufficiently protect the wires, or neglect the insertion of the lead which serves as a safety valve in the event of the current being too strong. Houses may be set on fire, human beings fatally shocked by the neglect of a bad or slovenly workman. The apparatus for my mansion was but just completed, and Mr. Square had come to inspect it and make sure that all was right. He was an enthusiast in the matter of electricity, and saw for it a vast perspective, the limits of which could not be predicted. "All forces," said he, "are correlated. When you have force in one form, you may just turn it into this or that, as you like. In one form it is motive power, in another it is light, in another heat. Now we have electricity for illumination. We employ it, but not as freely as in the States, for propelling vehicles. Why should we have horses drawing our buses? We should use only electric trams. Why do we burn coal to warm our shins? There is electricity which throws out no filthy smoke as does coal. Why should we let the tides waste their energies in the Thames, in other estuaries? There we have nature supplying us, free, gratis, and for nothing, with all the force we want for propelling, for heating, for lighting. I will tell you something more, my dear sir," said Mr. Square. "I have mentioned but three modes of force, and have instanced but a limited number of uses to which electricity may be turned. How is it with photography? Is not electric light becoming an artistic agent? I bet you," said he, "before long it will become a therapeutic agent as well." "Oh, yes, I have heard of certain impostors with their life belts." Mr. Square did not relish this little dig I gave him. He winced, but returned to the charge. "We don't know how to direct it aright, that is all," said he. "I haven't taken the matter up, but others will, I bet, and we shall have electricity used as freely as now we use powders and pills. I don't believe in doctors' stuffs myself. I hold that disease lays hold of a man because he lacks physical force to resist it. Now, is it not obvious that you are beginning at the wrong end when you attack the disease? What you want is to supply force, make up for the lack of physical power, and force is force wherever you find it. Here, motive, there, illuminating, and so on. I don't see why a physician should not utilize the tide rushing out under London Bridge for restoring the feeble vigor of all who are languid and a prey to disorder in the metropolis. It will come to that, I bet, and that is not all. Force is force everywhere. Political, moral force, physical force, dynamic force, heat, light, tidal waves, and so on. All are one. All is one. In time we shall know how to galvanize into aptitude and moral energy all the limp and crooked consciences and wills that need taking in hand, and such there always will be in modern civilization. I don't know how to do it. I don't know how it will be done, but in the future the priest as well as the doctor will turn electricity on as his principal, nay, his only agent. And he can get his force anywhere, out of the running stream, out of the wind, out of the tidal wave. I'll give you an instance, continued Mr. Square, chuckling and rubbing his hands, to show you the great possibilities in electricity used in a crude fashion. In a certain great city away far west in the States, a go-ahead place too, more so than New York, they had electric trams all up and down and along the roads to everywhere. The union men working for the company demanded that the non-unionists should be turned off, but the company didn't see it. Instead, it turned off the union men. It had up its sleeves a sufficiency of the others and filled all places at once.